Right now, humidity 66%. It is sunny and 76 in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be hearing from best-selling author Ryan Steck talking about his most recent novel. First, however, we're going to be paying tribute to Bill Moyers, renowned American journalist and political commentator, a best-selling author many times over, the host of an array of wonderful programs on PBS. He died this past Thursday, June 25th, at the age of 91. Here is an interview I was privileged to record with him back in 2004. Words scarcely convey how thrilled I am to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of the journalists whom I most highly admire, Bill Moyers, and I'm sure many of you share that admiration as well. Such a well-known journalist in television with all kinds of interesting, groundbreaking series to his credit, much first-rate writing as well. Most recently, a very thought-provoking book called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Time, published by The New Press. Bill Moyers, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
And I'm pleased to be with you, Greg.
One of the things you say in the foreword of the book is that so much of what especially broadcast journalists do has kind of an ephemeral quality. You say we write on the sand and speak in the wind, and usually by the morning there is there's not a trace of what we have written or said. Surely that's true to some extent, but do you really believe that all of the great work that you have done over the years is quite as transient as that?
I very much appreciate your generosity toward that work, but it's not in the sense that what people see and read at the moment shape their unintentionally and even unconsciously shape their psyche, shape their attitude, shape their values, and becomes a part of their DNA. I believe that. I'm a sum of all the wonderful documentaries I've seen, from Edward Murrow's first documentaries to more recent ones by Ken Burns and others, but in terms of changing anything at the moment and becoming relevant tomorrow, no, I can't. I don't think journalism is about tomorrow. I think it's about today. Now, the impact on the individual's consciousness and or unconsciousness is like sand building up on the beach. It can be there for a long time to come.
Tell us about this particular book and what is collected between these covers.
These are a series of essays and commentaries and speeches I've given over the years, edited and tweaked into a more readable narrative, trying to get to the heart of some of the things my journalism has been about. And essentially, my journalism of recent years has been about how do we save capitalism from its own excesses and how do we save democracy from its own inertia. And those are the themes of the book, even though there are essays on Lyndon Johnson and essays on growing old and essays on friendship, but essentially it's my concern for democracy that prompted me to write this book right now, to publish this book right now.
Quite a substantial portion of the book is devoted to the media. That is what part three of the book is called. But at one point during that book, you actually express some reluctance to even use the term media. Explain why the term media makes you uncomfortable, or the way in which you sometimes see that term may be misused.
Well, all of us who are in broadcasting or in newspapers or in magazines are grouped under this rubric of, the media, so that it seems as if the medium is the message, it seems that Oliver North's message when he's reporting for Fox News from Iraq is the same message of Bill Moyers when he's reporting on the news or analyzing the news for PBS, and that just simply isn't true. There are many messages in the media, not just one collective message. And I, you know, I try to make a distinction between Bill O'Reilly and Bill Moyers, so that I quote in the book a journalist who teaches at Case Western Reserve, who says, you know, the very concept of media is insulting to some of us within the press who find ourselves lumped with so many disparate elements, as if everyone with a pen, a microphone, a camera, or just a loud voice were all one and the same. And I feel that. I feel that we have to make distinctions about the kind of news and information and analysis we're getting, because that comes from different individuals with different perspectives.
Hmm. In talking about the current state of affairs in the United States, one thing you say at one point I think is particularly intriguing. You say that what you find so troubling today is democracy's inability to resolve some of the critical issues that face our nation. And you go on to say that one of the problems is that some of those most important questions are almost entirely off the screen of public debate.
That's true, Greg, and I appreciate your bringing that out. The fact of the matter is our political system has been bought out from under us. Democracy is drowning in a flood of big money contributed by a narrow, unrepresentative elite who get the access and therefore get the tax cuts, the policies, the subsidies, the benefits that they are buying, in effect, while the middle and working class, the working poor, are being robbed of their representation. I mean, we have government today of, by, and for the corporations. And because they have so much money that they put into the political system, they're the voices that get heard. As you and I talk this morning, the Senate has passed and the House just passed it yesterday right after midnight one of the biggest giveaways to big corporations that we've had in a number of years. I mean, these are companies that have played cynical tax games. This new bill that's going to pass creates new tax shelters for them, provides incentives for companies to move jobs overseas. For God's sake, you all in Milwaukee know what that has cost you. And yet they're doing it again. Why? Because they have bought the political access. That means they get the policies that matter, no matter how you vote in an election.
Hmm. You are not afraid to take on topics such as religion, which can be, of course, particularly divisive in this day and age. And you pose such a great question in one of your chapters, saying, in the real world of democracy, how do we cope with 1,000 local gods? How do I hold my truth to be the truth when everyone else sees truth differently? Such a great question, and especially a good question to be posed by someone reared in the Baptist faith, and in an era where there was little, if any, discussion at all between persons of different religious faiths. Is there an answer to that excellent question?
There is an answer, and it grows out of that essay in the book, grows out of a series I did a few years ago on the book of Genesis. I invited representatives of different faiths and of no faiths to come together and talk about those first great 10 stories in the Bible, the 10 founding stories of three faiths, if you will, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you know, story of Abraham, Ishmael, Hagar, Joseph, Jacob, right on down through the line of the founding dynasty of the monolithic faith. And I asked that question in that series because American religion is changing. It used to be that everybody looked like me and sounded like me, a white male of a Protestant European heritage. Now the world's religions are coming to this country. And religion, as you know, Greg, has a healing side. We all know that. We've seen the hospitals inspired by religious grace. We've seen the charity that has come out of religious conviction. But we also know that not only does religion have a healing side, it has a killing side. You see it in the first murder committed in the book of Genesis is by two sons of Abraham, of Adam, who are competing for God's favor. God chooses sides, chooses the gift of one over the gift of the other. The older brother kills the younger brother, and that red thread of religiously spilled blood runs right down to Beirut, Bosnia, and Baghdad today. So I ask that question because in a democracy, We can't impose our religious views on others. We are a secular democracy, which means everybody's views are tolerated. So if we're not going to wind up feuding and fighting over religion, and I think we may be if we're not careful, we have to answer that question. And that question is answered by the fact that we have to learn to listen. You know, we learn so much by listening to the loves of others, and we have to listen to other people as they describe their experience with reality, including transcendent reality, and we share ours in return. Then we may never agree with them, but we will at least know where they're coming from. And having listened, we won't be so enticed to hammer and proselytize.
Mm. Towards that end, one of my favorite lines in the book is when you say, talking with people who agree with you is like jogging in a cul-de-sac. I mean, really, it's just kind of a pointless enterprise in some respects, and yet so often that's exactly what happens in modern America.
And it's happening in politics. I mean, you know, we're not trying to argue with each other who's right and wrong. We're arguing with each other over who's good or who's bad. The right and the left just going at each other's throats, shouting right past each other, calling each other names instead of trying to persuade each other. Maybe I live in an idealized world, I don't know, but I do think of democracy as a conversation in which you set forth as articulately and powerfully as you can what you believe and what you want and why you want it, and the other side does the same, and then politics is the compromise that keeps us from, you know, from having a civil war, from having a religious war, from looking upon life as a holy war. And that's what democracy is all about. It's the necessary compromises that keep us from each other's throats.
Hmm. I could speak with you all day just about the chapter called Second Thoughts, in which you look back at your several years working in the administration of Lyndon Baines Johnson, experiences with him which you say were exhilarating and excruciating. What an interesting combination. But I want to ask you to explain a little further why you have been and remain so reluctant to write about that period, that you somehow doubt your ability to put it in context, or what is the reluctance there?
Well, first of all, I was very close to Lyndon Johnson for about 4 years, and I've never wanted to be the thief of his confidence. I spent many hours alone with him. He poured out his feelings to me, his fears, his hopes, his ambitions, his dreads, and he didn't think I was going to write a book about that. He could trust me, and I worry somewhat about these, particularly about these immediately written kiss and tell books that make it hard for men and women in public life to know whom to trust. Second, I've been reluctant to write about the Johnson years because I'm not sure I understand those years that I lived then. I mean, Freud, as you may remember, said we all experience our presence naively, and that's certainly true in my case. I had more energy than wisdom when I was in Washington, and even now I am tentative about how all the pieces fit together. You know, as I said, Lyndon Johnson was 13 of the most interesting people I've ever met. Well, I saw aspects of his personality that others didn't. I saw he was with me doing one thing and with somebody else doing another thing. And I don't know the whole of the man. I have said that I'm retiring from active television at the end of this year because I want to see if I can write a book that will be honorable and truthful without being subversive of our relationship. I'm not sure I can, but I'm gonna explore it.
Hmm. As you wrestle with the legacy of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and particularly the Great Society, you point out something which is so true and is worth talking about briefly: the idea that a slogan is a dangerous thing. Those who create it can lose control of its meaning. Others read into it what is or was not there. Friends put their own spin on it. It can mean everything or nothing. And of course, we live in a society which is surrounded by slogans, and whole political platforms are built upon them. Is there any way we can disengage from our attraction to the slogan?
Well, I hope that we could get back to where we didn't package everything with such grandiosity as, you know, a term like the Great Society. I know what we were reaching for. We were reaching for a good society. We were reaching for a society in which there were not extreme polarities, and in which what was good for the richest family was also good for the poorest family, and the society was devoted to trying to keep a balance between the wealth and the commonwealth. But that term, Great Society, got attached to it, and it struck people as overreaching, as grandiose, and it began to take on a life of its own that wasn't intended in its original use by the president. I'm not sure he ever understood it that way either. But that's what I mean when I say we have to be aware of packaging too much and too little, and taking the English language and turning it into bumper stickers or sound bites.
The book is Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Time, published by the New Press. Bill Moyers, I congratulate you on a superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it on today's morning show.
Same here, Greg.
The preceding morning show interview was recorded back in 2004. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're remembering journalist and political commentator Bill Moyers, who died this past Thursday, the 25th of June, at the age of 91. I thought it would be interesting today to replay a portion of my 2007 conversation with the son of Bill Moyers, William Cope Moyers, talking about his memoir, Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. This is the portion of our interview in which William Cope Moyers speaks specifically about his father and about their relationship.
There was some sort of hurt that seemed to drive so much of this, that left you dissatisfied with life and with yourself. And even to this day, do you fully understand just where those feelings were coming from that would lead you into such self-destructive behavior? Or, I mean, are you still trying to fully and completely understand that?
I am, Greg. And in fact, I still live with some of that. I think all of us are broken. That's the name of the book, Broken. I think we're broken in part because we are human. We are flawed. We're imperfect. And in many ways, we want more, whatever more is. Sure, I mean, I've been in recovery for 13 years, but I had a jagged existence, if you will. I have what I call a hole in my soul, this place that's sort of underneath my rib cage, which aches with a sense of imperfection, hurts with the pain of wanting more and not being good enough or measuring up enough. I think that's part of my psyche. It's not why I became alcoholic, but I think it helped to feed it. That hole in the soul helped to feed this condition of addiction. But sure, I mean, I am in recovery. I'm okay in my own skin today, but I still, you know, I still have my issues.
Hmm. One of those issues, of course, is that your father was and is an extraordinary person. By the way, I've had the pleasure of speaking with him on this program now several years ago. But for you, this was not certainly the whole situation, but it was part of what made you so uncomfortable in your own skin. I think you put it that way at some point in the book. Just talk for a moment again about that. And if even to this day that remains something of an issue for you.
Well, it does, and I appreciate your sensitivity to it. My father, the journalist Bill Moyers, is a man who casts a long shadow, and it's a shadow that over the decades I have come to both scorn and embrace, mostly embracing now. I mean, my father's is a good, fundamentally good man whose unconditional love for me has endured despite all the challenges that we've been through. But I grew up, you know, in a family where my father was a personality of sorts, a revered man in some sectors of the country, and scorned in others, obviously. But you know, he's been a noteworthy journalist for many decades. Before that, he was Lyndon Johnson's press secretary and chief of staff, and he helped set up the Peace Corps under John Kennedy. And before that, he was an ordained Southern Baptist minister. When I was born in 1959, that's what my father was doing. And so I grew up with a keen sense of my father's presence. But I think all of us, you know, whether we have a famous or a father or no father at all, whether we have a mother who beat us or a mother who, like my mother, loved me and loves me unconditionally, I think we all have these things that go into the dynamic of experience.
Hmm. I think it's important to say, too, that a very rich part of your book is with the letters that you received from your dad and some from your mother as well over the years. And I think it's important that this is said, that you have this famous father, but a father who told you over and over and over and over and over again how much he loved you, how much he admired your talent, how much he felt you had already accomplished and had the potential to accomplish still. I mean, your father said everything he could possibly said to sort of disavow you of this notion that I'm not as good as my father, I don't measure up to my father. And yet somehow those words were not enough to convince you to the core of your being.
No, and I appreciate you putting your finger on that, that the letters in the book are very potent, in part because they help to guide the reader through the processes that went into the spiral downward and then the climb back in addiction. Addiction is an illness that affects much more than just the person who has it. It affects the entire family. And in this case, it hurt my mother and hit my mother and impacted my father and my spouse and others. And so the letters sort of help bring the reader through that from the familial tie. And I think the letters also open up a window into the soul of a parent who does love his son unconditionally and wants only the best for his son and continues to try to help his son through this perplexing situation, because none of us really saw my addiction until we saw it, and that was towards the end of the spiral downward. My father was very engaged and remains engaged in my life, and yet at the same time, part of that engagement included him being inexorably linked to my spiral downward through my addiction. So the letters are very, very powerful. They not only validate the experience that I went through, but they help the reader to understand that addiction is a family disease.
A portion of my 2007 conversation with William Cope Moyers, talking about his book Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Mr. Moyers has served for a number of years on the staff of the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been enjoying a really thrilling and suspenseful book called Gone Dark, a Matthew Redd thriller. And this is a book set in the state of Montana amidst terrible wildfires and an inexplicable and horrifying case of actually mass murder occurs right in the middle of this wildfire. And on the scene to investigate is Matthew Redd, a well-known character in the books of Ryan Steck, my morning show guest, who is also an editor, founder and editor-in-chief of The Real Book Spy, and someone whose work has been very, very highly acclaimed. And he has crafted a book that not only draws upon his expertise and the research he has done, but also from some personal experiences in his own life. The book is published by Tyndale, located in close by Carroll Stream, Illinois. Gone Dark, a Matthew Redd thriller. And Ryan Steck, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk with you. I really enjoyed this book very, very much. Before we get into the book itself, I want to give you a chance to explain what The Real Book Spy is.
Absolutely. So a decade ago, I was actually transitioning from sports writing into the world of publishing. I've always been a fan of thrillers. Like, I love that one sit up all night reading experience, that feeling you get when you love a book so much you can't put it down, and you like pause just long enough to start canceling things on your schedule and your calendar so you can just sit and read. I love that feeling, and it became a passion of mine to help other readers find books that would provide that for them. So 10 years ago, I kind of just looked at the landscape of publishing and thrillers and mysteries, and the reality is it's sort of like the Oscars. You know, my wife watches the Oscars every year. I don't, and I've never even heard of the movies that win Best Picture, let alone seen them, and I just know I watch all the billion-dollar franchises like Fast and Furious and Mission Impossible, all those Marvel movies. I know all about those, but they never, like, do well in award ceremonies and stuff. And very, very similarly, that is how thrillers are sort of viewed in the publishing world. And so I launched TheRealBooksBuy.com, which is a one-stop shop for all things thriller and mystery. So reviews, exclusive interviews, breaking news, all kinds of stuff. So if you love thrillers and mysteries, you know, you can check that out. And that sort of is what led to me getting into the publishing world and becoming an editor and now an author.
This book is, I believe, the fourth to feature your main character, former Marine Raider Matthew Redd. Before talking about this specific character, I wonder if you could talk about the fun and the challenge of crafting a series of books. I mean, that feature a through line of a significant central character. I think when one enjoys reading those kind of books, it's easy to take for granted what is involved in creating this big, wide arc of a story that spans multiple books rather than just one. What have you found most intriguing and also maybe most challenging about writing in this particular sort of framework?
Well, what I love about it is when you're writing a series like this, people that meet Matthew Redd in my first book, Fields of Fire, he's just a former Marine Raider who in that book is coming back to his hometown in Montana for the first time in over a decade to investigate the death of his adopted father, only to unearth a global conspiracy that only he can stop. And when you meet Redd in that book, he's very much a lone wolf operator. And then if you meet him now in book four, he still kind of prefers to work by himself. He's got some communication and trust issues, but he's married. He has a family, and I really love that. I love the development of the characters from each book, and that's something I really personally enjoy because it's what I know. I'm married. I have six kids. I wrote my best friend into the book, my best friend in real life. His name is Mikey Durhammer, and that's Redd's best friend in my series. So I borrow a lot from real life and put my own sort of experiences and things like that, you know, fictionalized, of course, but I work that into my books, and that's something that has always been intriguing and interesting and fun for me. Now, the flip side to that is when you get into book four, you want readers to be able to pick up your latest book and jump right in. And every author will tell you, hey, you can buy this book. That's what you're supposed to say. It's what the publisher wants you to say. I don't know that's always true. You know, I think a lot of times a series book, like, I mean, I cover new releases for a living on The Real Book Spy. There's a lot of series out there. You don't want to jump in on book four, five, or six. Like, you really probably need to go back to the beginning. I really want readers to sincerely be able to, like, pick up this book, Gone Dark, jump right in and not lose anything. So the conundrum you always kind of face with that is how much of past events do you put in to this book? So when you're sort of recapping and explaining Redd's history, you know, you don't want to spoil the first three books. So that's always a challenge. How much backstory do you layer in and how much do you kind of explain without spoiling past events for new readers?
Right. The other thing, it seems to me, is that just as with a long-running television series, for instance, like a show like ER with a character like Dr. Carter, who begins in the first season as a bumbling newcomer, and by the end of the series, he wasn't a regular quite to the end, but for more than a dozen seasons, he figured in the show and evolved and grew into this actually quite assured and mature doctor, and it made sense. But I think there are other cases in which a character grows and changes and matures and sometimes maybe loses their magic or becomes darker and more conflicted, and what we really liked was the character in their kind of original freshness. It seems to me that an author faces a really interesting conundrum when you are taking a character and carrying him across multiple books. How much does a given character change from the first book to the last?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. In my series, quite a bit. You know, like I mentioned, You Meet Red in Fields of Fire. That was my first book, and he's really this lone operator, kind of lost everyone and everything that matters to him, and is forced to go home to Montana. Now, you know, he's in such a different place. He's married. He's got children. He's running a cattle ranch. He really wants to leave the life of action behind. Of course, I can't let that happen. You know, not unless I stop getting book deals and maybe he'll ride off into the sunset. But as long as, you know, there's readers that want to read the books and the publisher that wants to put them out, I can't really let Red have his happy ever after on the ranch. So you got to find reasons to get him kind of, you know, out of doing chores and back into the action. But I really, really want to structure my own series so that events happen in one book and then things carry over. Like, I think we live in a world where we watch movies where, like, the heroes are shot and then they're totally fine in the very next scene. And I think it's more accepted when you're writing books. You know, if there's a character who's injured or goes through something in one book, they're generally back to normal at the start of the next. And I never really wanted to portray Matthew Red that way. So the things that he deals with on a book-to-book basis really shape what he's facing and what he's going through and who he is in that next book.
He is, as we've already said, a former Marine raider, and he is physically quite formidable. He is also someone with a really great heart and really great instincts and so on. I mean, in some ways, he's almost a superhero, even though he is obviously a human being, but somebody that is so admirable, so compelling, I mean, heroic in the very, very best sense of the word. What did you think about as you constructed who he is and whether or not there should be flaws or darker sides or that kind of thing? I mean, I love this character exactly as he is. I take no issue whatsoever with who he is and how he is how you have constructed him. But I'm just curious what went through your mind in terms of constructing a truly heroic character like Matthew Red.
Well, first of all, thank you. You know, Red's very real to me, and he's lived in my head for a long time. Like, the origin of Matthew Red for me goes back 20-plus years to when I was a sophomore in high school. And I was the kid that failed every English class. I don't think any teacher would have ever thought or projected I would someday be an editor, work in publishing, and then become an author. So, you know, it's funny to look back on. But we had an intern for one of my creative writing classes, and no one would take anything seriously, including myself. And then one Friday, she just, like, assigned us this new project. She said, you can swear, you can have violence, you can write action. I don't care. Just go home and write. So when I'm, you know, a 16-year-old kid, like, I hear that, and I went all out, just full of, wrote a short story full of, you know, bad language and all kinds of action. And the funny thing about it is I literally created the character Matthew Red then. So I wrote this short story about this kid who protects his high school from, you know, these bad guys that were looking to harm a teacher. And so he becomes like a vigilante. Well, that story was so over the top and full of bad language and stuff. I ended up getting suspended from school for a week. It's a true story. And it's worth mentioning because all these years later, like, I'm in publishing. I want to start writing. It's always been a dream of mine to tell stories. I just started thinking, you know, what would that kid be up to? I couldn't really let him go. Red always sort of lived in my head, and I just wanted to explore and tell his story. And so, armed with a new perspective on life, you know, being a father and an adult, like, I just reimagined the character now as a grown man. And the funny thing about it is that principal who suspended me all those years ago is now my kid's high school principal. He reads the books. He's a fan. And he recently just said to me, you know, I love your books. I'm so sorry, you know, for what happened. And I told him, I think it worked out pretty well. I got a week off school and a couple book deals out of it. So I'm not too mad. But, you know, when I was constructing and creating Red as an adult character for my own series now, I'm a big fan of, like, boxing and MMA and stuff like that. And I can't help but notice, you know, what are the biggest draws? It's always the heavyweight fighters. And so I think the people with, like, real knockout power, you're going to see some fireworks. People get excited about that. And so when I created Red, it was very intentional. I made him 6'3.5", 265 pounds of muscle. He's a big guy. He's a sledgehammer in a scalpel's world. Now, when I do radio, I get asked a lot, Ryan, how much are you and Matthew Red alike? And because you can't see me, I can get away with saying we're, like, exactly the same. We share the same body type and everything. When I'm doing television and podcasts, I can't get away with that, so I do love radio. But, you know, the reality is I wanted a big guy, but he's layered. There's a lot to – there's depth to Red. You know, he's on a faith journey. He's a family man. He loves his wife. He loves his children. He doesn't really want to have to go be the hero all the time.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
We're speaking with Ryan Steck, and we're about to begin digging into his latest Matthew Red thriller, which is called Gone Dark, set in Montana and set amidst a raging wildfire, at least at the outset. And sort of the central event of the novel takes place right in the heart of such a wildfire. From what I can tell, you must have done some thorough research on the nature of wildfires and how one most effectively fights them and what the experience is of people who fight such fires. Tell us about your journey of discovery to understand a whole lot more about these destructive fires than most of the rest of us know.
Well, you know, the thing that really caught me off guard is I was working on the book. I had just started it, and this was last year, and I'm in Southwest Michigan. So we were getting a lot of smoke from the wildfires in Canada. And I knew about wildfires. You know, I'd done a lot of research, but I didn't even know, like, smoke jumpers was a thing. I had no idea at all. So if you're listening and you don't know what a smoke jumper is, like, it turns out, if you want a little more action and thrills in your life and you're looking for a career change, there are firefighters known as smoke jumpers, and their job is they literally ride in by helicopter and, like, jump down and fight forest fires from the inside out. So that, to me, was, like, terrifying and horrific, and thank God we have people that want to do that for a living. But I started reading about it and just couldn't wrap my head around it and thought, that is so wild. I got to write about these guys. And, of course, the way my brain works as a thriller novelist, I thought, well, you know, what if a team of smoke jumpers was deployed into the middle of a wildfire in Montana but suddenly went dark? And what if someone like Matthew Red was sent in to figure out what happened to them and finds that they've all been executed? And I just couldn't get over this thought of, man, who would do that? Who would start executing smoke jumpers in the middle of a wildfire? And that's really where the whole genesis, the idea for Gone Dark, came from.
Mm. At this point, as this story is undertaken, and as this team of smoke jumpers is suddenly lost for no explanation, Matthew Red is summoned as a qualified rescue technician. And you tell us that this is something that he has fairly recently folded into his life, and that it's work he enjoys, which, in your words, was kind of like leading a Boy Scout troop for grown-ups. Tell us more about what this sort of work is and why it folds so well into who Matthew Red is.
Well, you know, my stories are, like, outdoorsy types. If you're a big fan of, like, CJ Box or Craig Johnson, my stuff is probably perfect for you. And those are literary heroes of mine, and they're both friends of mine. So it's pretty surreal to have my work often compared to theirs. Yeah, I just think it fit, you know, who Red is. He's a cattle rancher. He's working with local law enforcement. He kind of wears a lot of hats, as in this book, he's really searching for what he'll do long term. He's got bills to pay. So as he's trying to get, you know, the ranch going, his unique set of skills lends itself pretty well to a lot of the stuff happening around in Montana. But again, this is coming back to smoke jumpers. I was just really fascinated that there's people who like sign up this to be their job, to get dropped into the middle of a forest fire and fight that fire from the inside out. Like, I can't think of almost anything I'd rather do less than that. So, you know, the more I read about it, the more I realized, okay, I got to use this. It just, it felt like the kind of thing Matthew Redd would probably do. This goes right back to, like, we need people that are going to take on the jobs that everyday men and women probably aren't built for. And this is something that Redd is just built for.
Right. And, of course, stepping into a challenging scenario like a raging wildfire. You write at one point, wildfires in late summer were a fact of life in Montana, in a state that was mostly wilderness and open range, with a climate and topography that favored lightning storms on hot afternoons when the prairie grass was stick dry. Fire was just another type of weather. The fact that it's a natural part of life there does not mean it isn't incredibly dangerous and unpredictable. And, of course, that is a part of what is swirling around this central event that is so important in your story. There is a parallel story that eventually intertwines, and that involves the sad specter of addiction. And this is something Matthew Redd's wife, Emily, is dealing with as a doctor. And I think you paint such a poignant story of a patient that she is working with, a former schoolmate, actually, who ultimately dies of a drug overdose and sets Emily Redd on sort of a mission of her own. I know that, at least to some extent, you are writing from some personal experience when we get to this other plot line in Gone Dark.
That's right, yeah. You know, it's interesting. When you become a novelist, I think initially your goal is just to entertain readers. And after a few books, you've kind of written the stories that you kind of hoped you were going to get to tell. So here I am. You know, this is the fourth book in my series, but I've also taken over the Alex Hawk series for the late Ted Bell, who was a New York Times bestselling author, and I have another series I'm co-writing with another author friend of mine named Simon Gervais called The Second Son. So eventually, like, I come back to my own series, and I started to look at it just a little differently. I want to entertain readers, but with this book, it was the first time in my career I kind of thought about, what do I want to say? You know, not just how do I want to entertain. That, of course, is always the first thing I'm trying to do with my books, but what do I want to say here? And there's just things that I layer into the plot. I'm never very heavy-handed about some of this stuff. Look, as a believer and Christian myself, that naturally works its way into my story ever so slightly. Like, Red's on a faith journey, I think, in the same way that a lot of men are, and we're seeing a lot of people right now in our country. Addiction is another thing I needed to tackle. It's something I waited to do and even talk about. But I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober 16 years. I also battled Vicodin addiction because of some of, like, the overprescribing of opioids years ago for things I went to, medical stuff I went through. I know what it's like. I know that battle. I know how horrific it is. And in talking with other people that have really shared a lot of the struggles that I've been through and thankfully overcome, but through conversations with people that have had to climb that mountain too, like, you hear the most heartbreaking things. And I just felt like it was finally time. You know, here we are, book four, Red's pretty established. The series is doing well and the readers seem to like them. I knew I was going to keep readers entertained. I knew that was my main job, but I wanted to start touching on some issues that meant a lot to me. So, you know, faith, addiction, and adoption. Those are three really big themes in this book.
I love especially the way you handle the whole matter of adoption. We should say that the character Matthew Redd, in the course of investigating this terrible series of murders, comes across and essentially rescues a young boy. And the story of their connection and what ultimately happens to this young boy is a very, very important part of your story. I want to talk about the faith thing for just a moment, just because
sure.
for people who, who aren't as acquainted with Tyndale Publishing as I am, much of what Tyndale publishes is quite overtly faith-based material. I mean, books about the Christian faith and so on. This is a book in which there is an element of faith, and yet I think it's fair to say that this is not a book that is, what would be the word, heavy-handed? This does not feel like a book that was written with some sort of hidden message or for the purpose of proselytizing. It's written with sort of a sense of comfort and ease when it comes to faith. These are interesting people, and one of the things about them that makes them interesting is that their religious faith is important for them in a way that once in a while we see in sort of mainstream literature, but actually not all that often. I wonder if you could just say a word about folding the matter of faith into the lives of certain characters in your book and what you thought about in terms of how to do that, how to treat that particular facet of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking the question, too. You know, there's nothing that I hate more as a reader than when an author is interjecting their own political or religious beliefs and opinions into the story. It takes me right out of it. So I don't want to do that. You kind of hit the nail on the head. You know, this series is with Tyndale, but these are not Christian thrillers at all. These are thrillers written for a secular author audience that just so happens to have a little bit of a faith message in there, but nothing heavy-handed or beating you over the face with it. In the same way that I'm a Christian, but I'm also a thriller writer. You know, I don't look at myself as a Christian thriller writer. It's not what I do. I cut my teeth as a reader and a fan and a critic on Vince Flynn and Brad Thor and now Jack Carr, and they're all friends of mine as well. I love Jason Bourne. You know, I love Robert Ludlum. I love stories like that. So that's what I wanted to write, and very much so that's how I think of Matthew Redd. He is just Jason Bourne out west. You know, that was how he was pitched early in my career. But yet my faith is so important to me, it would just be disingenuous, I think, to not put some of that into the book. So much of me is in my books. Like, my real-life best friend is Red's best friend. My real-life dog, Rubble, who's a 144-pound Rottweiler, is Red's dog, too. Hmm. So it's just a pretty natural thing for me. And then when we get into some of these other issues that we've discussed, like addiction, a big part of me overcoming that, you know, was my faith in my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Like, I'm a practicing Christian. My church is very important to me. That's how we raise our kids. But it's not the message I want to necessarily send with my books. I want my books to entertain, and I want you to have fun. So it's not heavy-handed. I'm not trying to win any arguments or convert anybody or anything like that. It's just kind of a journey that Red is on because, to be really honest with you, I just love the idea of an action hero like Red, who, by the way, his father-in-law is a preacher. I love this idea that, like, he might sit in a church on Sunday, and Monday, you know, he's got to go, like, kill people.
Battling the bad guys.
Yeah, like, I just really love that moral conundrum of facing, like, you know, thou shalt not kill. And then Monday, like, I got to go kill these bad guys. And that just kind of made me laugh, and I thought, look, I want to explore that and just see where this goes. So I try to, you know, keep realism is important to me, you know, so with characters, with setting and everything that they're doing. So again, never want to be heavy-handed, not looking to, you know, subliminal messages or anything like that. It's just very real to me, so very naturally some of that comes out in Matthew Redd too.
The book again is Gone Dark, a Matthew Redd thriller published by Tyndale House Publishers and the author Ryan Steck. Ryan Steck, congratulations on a fantastic book. It is indeed a thriller. And I really enjoyed it and look forward to further Matthew Redd adventures in the future. And thanks for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we plan on having a conversation with Dr. Maggie Burke, conductor of the Carthage Choir, and four or five of the students who went with Dr. Burke on a tour of England and just got back a few days ago. We'll be hearing all about it on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Well, the heat wave is returning under sunny skies. We are headed for a high today of 89 degrees with rather high humidity. Clear overnight with a low of 65. Tomorrow, a high of 89 degrees once again. The 4th of July will also be hot, probably a high of 91 degrees. Very hot on Saturday as well. We do show some chance of rain as we get to Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Continued very warm. This is WGTD HD.